Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. It's great to be back. Another packed program today. Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board, will join us. The board regulates just about everything regarding health care in Vermont. And after we speak with Al Gobay, then we'll check in with our colleagues in D.C. live at Talk Media News, and then Jasper Craven, a Vermont Digger reporter. Jasper wrote a piece that I just found fascinating, talking about relatives of members of Congress who lobby Congress. And one of those is Alicia Leahy Jackson, the daughter of Senator Leahy. And we'll find out what are some of the connections between what Ms. Jackson lobbies for and the organization she lobbies for, and Senator Leahy. And then we'll open up the phone lines. We're having debates at the Tunbridge Fair on Thursday and Friday for the position of governor, lieutenant governor, and AG. And also, I decided to put a local state representative race in there because oftentimes they get overlooked. But members of the House do important things, and it is important that we understand where they stand on the issues. So the local state representative race in the Tunbridge area will include in the debate schedule. And what I'd like to know when we open up the mic in the last part of the program is, what questions would you ask the candidates? So that's what we're doing today. But before we get to Al Gobay, I do want to acknowledge that Steve Cormier is signing off the air today at our sister station at 101 The One and devoting all his time as director of sales here at Radio Vermont. For those that didn't know, for over a year, he got up at God knows how early in the morning to do the morning show and then had his day job, a regular full-time day job in his capacity as sales. Also, we've been on the air for just over a year now, and this year has gone by so quickly. You know, I've enjoyed every minute of this year, and I hope you have too. I went back and listened to some of our first week of tapes over the weekend, and I guess I could describe it as there was room for improvement in those first weeks that we were on the air.
Well, it probably didn't help that I had no idea what I was doing in here and kept hanging up on people, so it wasn't. I thought your first day was very good. Should have just stopped there. No,
well, some of the technical difficulties last year, for example, at the Tunbridge Fair, where we had several hours of
tones.
Tones, I guess, is what it is.
You got through that well, though.
But we've learned a lot over the year, and our motivation every day is to bring a program that is informative, and I believe as I looked over the program over the year, I believe we've succeeded in doing that. My hope is in the upcoming year is to continue our commitment to inform you, even sometimes with humor, as we did with an author that described her experience when she bought a country store in southern Vermont, as well as the times we've had Rusty DeWeese on. And one of the most powerful shows we've had over the year, as I was reviewing, one of the most powerful programs we had was the Veterans Day program last year, where we had the daughters of two former SEALs who had died. And that was a very, very powerful program. I want to thank everyone here at WDEV and Radio Vermont for the support they've given me. And most of all, I want to thank all of you, and especially Tom, who's put up with me for this year. Here's my promise for you for the upcoming year. We'll continue to work hard to fulfill our commitment to inform, and that's what we will continue to do. Coming up, Al Gobay. And the reason Al is here is we're our continued focus on healthcare, because it is so important to you personally, as well as to the state's economy. It's a very important subject. Al Gobay, chair of the Green Mountain Care Board, when we come back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the WDEV studios Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board. I got it written wrong on my script here. So, you know, I read what I see.
Good morning.
Good morning, Al. Thank you for joining us. Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board, here in studio. Al, where are we going with healthcare? I think that's what's on the forefront of most people's mind.
Well, first of all, let me throw a shout out to Corm. I can't believe it's his last day. He's a great man.
He's still here, though.
Yeah, I got to go downstairs and give him a hug before I leave. So, I think that where we're heading with healthcare, I think the first thing you have to do is pan out nationally, and you have to understand what's happening nationally, because in Vermont we tend to think that everything here is a local focus, local birthed and local generated. And so nationally, we've seen the Affordable Care Act begin. We've seen the Affordable Care Act stumble. You know, there's a lot of press around the country right now about failed insurance policies for exchanges. And there's a lot of talk with Medicare changing the way it pays at the federal level. You know, so there's a lot of things going on nationally that we discuss here locally. And it, frankly, it's confusing for the average person. And they think that a lot of those things are started, you know, by Vermont. And it's hard to separate the two. So in general, where I believe healthcare is going is we're moving to a place where we have to make a profound decision on whether we can change the way we pay for healthcare. I know that when you were in the Douglas administration, you did some great work with the Blueprint for Health. Basically, the Blueprint is a program that was created to pay primary care doctors differently, so that they weren't just paid for every 15-minute office visit, so that they could focus on the true needs of their patient, and more longitudinally than just a 15-minute visit. And the Blueprint has won great accolades. It's actually proven to work, and it's a really good thing for Vermont. And so the point is that type of thinking going to be able to deliver better care to Vermonters? We know that healthcare is not affordable. It's not affordable to the state folks that have to do the Medicaid budget. It's not affordable to the federal government that has to fund Medicare. And it's not affordable to individuals and families that are trying to buy it. So there will always be a focus and a push to make it more affordable. My concern in that is that whenever we start talking about affordability, it's affordable to who? Affordable to the government, affordable to the family are two very different conversations. People tend to want to believe that if somebody else is paying for it, somehow that's affordable. And in healthcare, I think we've had the great debate about that. And the answer is that it's not affordable in the largest scale that it can be, which is across all payers. And so there will be a continued push to work toward affordability. And that is why the focus on how we pay for and deliver care.
There are three stools to healthcare, at least in my mind, which is access, affordability, which we just talked about, and quality. Those are the three legs to a stool as I look at healthcare. I want to get back to affordability in just a moment. But in terms of access, are we there yet?
No. You know, I think that there's parts of the state where we don't have enough primary care. There's parts of the state, you know, I think it's the number's a little over 50% of primary care panels are closed to new patients. You know, so I think that we have a ways to go just with primary care, let alone other specialty care. There's some mental health and substance abuse access issues all around the state. And so I think access has to continue to be, you know, it's called the triple aim in healthcare policy circles of access, quality, and cost. And, you know, access is not solved.
One of the things with access that has been the focus in the past is getting insurance access. And now we're seeing sort of the access debate starting to change, and you just brought it up, getting access to primary care. In some cases, getting access to specialists and some other places, but you see the blockage, you hear about the blockage, at least in primary care. People can't get primary care doctors. How do you overcome that?
Well, you know, first of all, let me agree with you. I think that there was a belief that if you didn't have insurance, you didn't have access. And that's true, because if you don't have insurance, you typically aren't doing the preventative care and seeing your primary care doctor. You typically go to the emergency room when there's an acute problem. And so that was what the Affordable Care Act set out to try to fix. And in Vermont, you know, we have a very, very low number of uninsured now. And so that's a good thing. So now you have your insurance policy and you're going out to try to find a doctor. And how does that go? If you can't get into primary care, that's not going very well. And so the question you just asked, which is, you know, sort of why and how do you fix it, you got to think about the incentives in the healthcare system. And that's why when we talk about changing the way we pay, why it's so profound. Currently, if a hospital hires a primary care doc, that's actually going to generate a loss for that institution, because primary care doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs actually keep people healthy just by merely being the service and the type of folks they are. And so what that does is it actually lowers other services provided by the hospitals, such as emergency room visits, that actually generate revenue to pay the bills. And so if you change the incentives in healthcare, the first thing that you would do as a newly changed CEO is you'd say, we need way more primary care than we currently have. Because you aren't going to keep people healthy by having orthopedic surgeons. You know, they're sort of the end of the game of health when you have an acute problem. We have great orthopedic surgeons in this state, but we need more primary care.
One of the things that I hear is just in terms of access, and you're absolutely right. We have 96% now that have access to insurance or some type of insurance. The 4%, you could argue, doesn't want it.
You know, right. You're not going to get to 100%. So what is full employment or what is full health insurance? That'll be debated, but I think we're pretty close.
So the shift is, how do we get access? And one of the things that some will contend, one of the ways is to build more sort of competition and capacity. And one of the things that we've seen in the news lately is this sort of outpatient same-day surgical unit that wants to be, I think it's in Colchester. And doesn't that solve some of the problem, or does that complicate some of the problem?
Well, it's a matter currently before the board, so I'm on thin ice talking about it. So let's not talk about that in specific.
Let's talk about the thing in general in terms of access.
Yeah. So the question has to be, do we have an access problem for what that entity, any entity that wants to open, is going to provide? You know, we have pretty good data that says we have access issues in primary care. And in fact, primary care doesn't have to go through the certificate of need process because of the way the law was structured, and rightly so. I think that case can be made. Whether we have access issues for procedures or for ambulatory surgical conditions, that is what that case is about, and that'll be decided down the road.
One of the things that I've heard again and again is when there's consolidation, and we'll get to consolidation in a minute, as well as we'll get to all payer, which is where you started out with in a minute. But when there's consolidation, especially with a major hospital like UVM Medical Center, one of the things that upsets both the doctor, the provider, and the patient is the fact the day that they consolidate, their prices go up. Why?
So, first of all, that's not always true. We've done some research into that. In central Vermont, when the surgeons moved in, they didn't go up. But typically that is true, and that's because of the way that hospitals are paid. And if you ever study the way that medical care is paid for by the different payers, two things will happen. One, you'll become incredibly frustrated, and the second is your head will hurt. You know, so Medicare, for example, pays a facility fee to hospitals and doesn't pay a facility fee to individual providers. And so that thing called provider-based billing makes it so it's more expensive in a hospital setting than in a private doctor setting. Next thing is that hospitals may get a better rate than the independent physicians. There's a provider parity law that was passed a couple of years ago to try to get at that. And so the question is, should they be paid the same? What is equitable pay? Taking into account things such as Medicaid paying lower than cost, Medicare paying at or below cost. You know, how do we factor all that into what is the proper equitable payment?
One of the things you've been grappling with over the past, I guess, few weeks are hospital budgets. You had hearings on hospital budgets. What do you look for in those hospital budgets?
So first of all, it's a monumental task. I mean, we're talking about well over $2 billion in net patient revenue that we have to review and the expenses that go along with it. And what we're really looking for is, a combination of, what's driving the revenue of the hospital? How is that affecting the margin that the hospital produces? How does that affect the workforce and service line deliveries? So we try to look at it. This triple aim concept of access, cost, and quality is kind of the way. And we've set a growth target for the hospitals over the last 4 years, starting with 4%, then 3.8%, then 3.6%, and this year it was 3.4%, trying to lower the rate of growth of the hospitals. And so we've had some results with that have been positive, and we've had some results with that have been less than positive. But in the aggregate, for the last 4 years, the hospitals have been below 4%. And I think that's pretty strong work for the state.
One of the most fascinating conversations that I saw come out of those hearings actually happened between the exchange between UVM Medical Center and one of your board members, where it was about cost shift. And whether there is a cost shift. Is there a cost shift?
So this is a big philosophical debate in health policy circles. Basically the concept is, do insurance companies, commercial insurance companies, willingly and understanding the whole spectrum of health policy, allow their prices to be higher because they know that Medicaids are lower? I'm a restaurant owner, that seems kind of odd and doesn't seem believable on the surface of it. So I try not to even think about it that way. I really just look at the price disparity. If Medicaid pays $75 for an office visit and Medicare pays, $95 for an office visit and commercial pays $125 for an office visit and you're a provider trying to make ends meet in your practice, who do you want your next patient to be? You're hoping a commercial customer walks in because you're trying to keep the lights on. When you're a hospital, and you're trying to, run, Porter, for example, they've had some issues recently. The percentage of Medicaid patients that are paying well below cost certainly drive your thinking as a CEO or CFO of that hospital. So while the debate may rage forever about is there a true cost shift, there is a price disparity between the three payer groups, and that drives the incentives around that drive behavior in the healthcare world, and that can't be denied.
But here's where I'm getting a little bit confused. Budgets with hospitals, especially UVM Medical Center, was basing some of their budgeting on a cost shift. The question is, if there is a cost shift or isn't there a cost shift, doesn't that sort of make a huge difference?
No, because the cost shift implies that people are willing participants in a scheme. What I'm saying is that we know that Medicaid doesn't pay cost at UVMMC. We know that the NICU is underfunded. Every newborn that goes there is typically on Medicaid. And so the hospital has to in some way cover the cost of that through some other service line. And so because of just that fact, that creates a shift between payers. Commercial payers and those patients that purchase commercial policies are paying for government programs that underpay. If you want to call that a cost shift, a payment disparity, that's what it is. And that is the reason why federally qualified health centers exist, because they get reimbursement that is better than other providers get from the government payers, specifically Medicaid.
As we look around the environment over the last few years in healthcare, particularly hospitals, a lot of consolidation with practices, with other hospitals. Are we moving towards a system where it may not be single payer, but maybe single provider?
I think that's a fair question. I think that when you look back over the last 15, 20 years in the state, the University of Vermont Medical Center has been upper 40s to almost 50% of the hospital revenue dollars for a long time. Not, you know, a lot of people think it just happened in the last couple of years. It's just not the case. And the reason for that is that they're the tertiary medical center for the state of Vermont, the other one being Dartmouth. And so, you know, you can draw an east-west line down the state, and those to the west side, you know, that academic medical center is where you're going to go to get certain types of care that you can't get at another hospital. And so it drives revenue because they have service lines that others don't have. They're always going to be bigger, regardless of whether there's, you know, prior to the Affordable Care Act, prior to Algo Bay, prior to the Green Mountain Care Board, it's the way that services are delivered. Just as an example, dialysis. Dialysis is performed typically by the University of Vermont Medical Center in a lot of settings. And in fact, at North Country Hospital, the dialysis clinic is run by the University of Vermont Medical Center because that's their level of care. That's the right thing to have happen. It's not done because they're a bully and trying to throw their weight around. It's because they have the folks that know how to do those things. So every hospital is not like every hospital. Grace Cottage is about a $19 million in revenue hospital. You know, UVM Medical Center is a one-plus billion-dollar net patient revenue hospital. They're very different entities, and they need to be.
When we talk about consolidation, as you look at it, and we just, you know, talked about sort of the consolidation that's happening in the industry, in particular in Vermont, do we eliminate competition when we have consolidation? And is that good for healthcare prices, or is that bad for healthcare prices?
So I think you have to start with the question of, is the majority of healthcare a free market? I don't think it is. I think there's parts of healthcare that are a free market. But the vast majority of it I don't see as a free market, meaning if you're in an independent doctor's practice and you have a heart attack, they're going to call an ambulance and send you to the University of Vermont Medical Center if you're, you know, in that area. There's no bid. You're not pricing out that transaction. I mean, I know what capitalism is, and that's not the way this functions. And so the question is, in a non-competitive marketplace like healthcare, where you do not have a willing buyer and a willing seller at all times, how do we control prices? You know, that's the profound question facing the United States of America and other countries in the world. It's not a Vermont alone problem.
I'm just trying to paint a picture of what healthcare could look like in the future. And could it look like a utility, Green Mountain Power, for example, where it has virtually it provides virtually all the power to Vermonters here in the state?
You know, it's funny. A lot of people ask that. And, you know, people, meaning the employees that deliver care, don't behave like electrons. You know, so it's just not that simple. What I think is that you could see an integrated model that is statewide, that maybe even is larger than statewide. You know, companies like Kaiser Permanente do a very good job, Geisinger, of delivering care across, you know, broad populations in a very efficient, high-quality way. You know, there's a lot to be learned from that.
We're speaking with Al Gobay, who's the chair of the Green Mountain Care Board. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Todd, do we need two breaks or one break in this hour? One break. I'll take it up to the quarter of the hour on this. One of the things that we had talked about earlier was the all-payer waiver. Can you just... I know this is going to be probably the hardest question I ask. Can you explain what the all-payer model is so that everybody understands it?
So I think that would probably take more time than you have given me on the radio this morning. But basically, the all-payer model waiver is a Medicare waiver. It's a waiver of some of the Medicare rules to allow flexibility for the state to be able to, in partnership with the federal government, basically take a program that Medicare currently has called NextGen and modify it so that providers in the state willingly, because they want to, could choose to participate in a new model of payment.
One of the things about the model as I looked at it is there's some risk here in this model in going to the all-payer. And the risk is, suppose for a moment you get it wrong on the assumptions, on the expenditure assumptions. Because what you're basically doing, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're agreeing to a certain amount of reimbursement in a certain way.
Right.
So if you're wrong on the assumptions, isn't that a huge problem for the state of Vermont?
Well, let's talk about the way we handle Blue Cross. You know, the 77,000 covered lives that are in the exchange that Blue Cross did a rate case on over the summer with us, you know, that's the same exact type of thing. You got to figure out who is the population, what are the health needs of the population, and based on history, what do we think they're going to spend in the coming year? And that's, we call that rate review. And you basically figure out per person how much it would cost per month. It's called per member per month. And we do that with Blue Cross, and that's how the rates are established in the exchange. And so it's done all across the United States for insurance cases. It is also done with large hospital systems. And so the question is, can you take a given subsection of the Medicare population and accurately determine what it would cost to deliver care in the coming year?
But here's the difference, I think.
And I think you can, is my answer.
But here's the difference, I think, in that with the rate cases that you're talking about with the health insurers, there's the ability to increase rates if you get it wrong. If there's some sort – in future years, there's some – with this, there's a cap in the all-payer model. Unless I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
There's a cap. Okay.
You're wrong. So there's no cap. What there is there's a goal for the entire state.
But there's an inflation factor, isn't there, in this?
We would call that medical trend or pharmaceutical trend.
Right. What happens if you go over the trend?
So if you go over the trend, then the provider group, the accountable care organization, is going to actually spend more money on care than it took in. And so the question is, what do you do next year because of that? You know, that's the question. And by the way, it's the same exact thing that happens with Blue Cross and MVP.
Is it the same thing that happens with Global Commitment, where you have sort of the trend rate?
So what's interesting with Global Commitment, and I know you were a part of that, and it's been very good for the state. You know, the state said to the federal government, hey, give us a block grant, basically, of money, and we won't use more than that. And if we do, that's on us. And so we did that, and that's about a $1.3 billion block grant at this point. And that's worked really well for the state. I mean, I think we can do this type of math and get it pretty accurate. That shouldn't be the reason we do this or don't do it. We should, when we bring this back and explain it to Vermonters, we should decide if we think this is the right thing for providers and patients. We can get the math right with the federal government, just like you did with the Global Commitment Waiver.
Let's go to the phone line, and we're speaking with Al Gobay, who's chair of the Green Mountain Care Board. If you want to give us a call, 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Morning. Hey, would the health care become a big, gigantic utility? Because it looks like all the insurance companies are starting to consolidate, and then the hospitals will, doctors will, and then pretty soon the insurance company will own everything.
Yeah, that's the question I asked earlier. Go ahead, Dale.
So I think that I'll answer this the way I answered it once before when I was asked. You know, right now in our country, we have six basic health care systems. We have Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, the Indian Health System, Obamacare, and then another thing called ERISA, which is basically large company health plans. And those six separate systems you know, basically provide the method of payment, but also impact the delivery of care. And, you know, I think that over time, depending on who's president, they're going to have to take a look at the inefficiencies of having six fundamental systems. That doesn't mean that we should move to a government-controlled single-payer system. That's not what I'm advocating for. But the way that these systems interface is completely inefficient. And over time, that's going to have to be addressed as a nation.
Let's go to Michael in Waitsfield. Michael, you're on Open Mic with Al Gobay. Good morning.
Good morning. I think one of the most important things that you brought up is the capitalism aspect. When you said you need to have a willing buyer and a willing seller. And you don't have willing buyers when it comes to medical, when it comes to people who are uneducated that need the service of a specialist system. Nobody has a medical education. Nobody can determine what you really need. So one of our problems, I think, is that we're all afraid of anything that's non-capitalistic. I mean, I built my whole life on capitalism, and I think capitalism is very important. But I was always involved in buyers that knew what they were buying. How could a seller of medicine is dealing with customers that have no idea what they're buying? So I think we have a philosophical problem where we're afraid of anything non-capitalistic.
How do you address that?
So,
thank you, Michael.
So I'm afraid of anything non-capitalistic, is the way I would say it. So the question is, what do you do when you don't have a willing buyer and a willing seller? And, you know, the debate can default to, you know, the government running it. And I just don't know that the government always runs things well. And so the question is, how do we have, you know, and Mike brought this up, you know, we have a pretty good method of delivering electricity to my house and my businesses, and it's a government regulated, but it's a private system. And, you know, that's what I think you need to do in healthcare. I just think that the difference is that we have federal programs and state programs and commercial programs and a method of payment that makes it really hard to get a clear view as a regulator. And so, you know, over time, that's going to have to shift as, you know, affordability will become the only leg of the stool that matters at some point here.
Let's go to Bob in Calais. Bob, you're on Open Mic with Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board.
Thanks a lot. Real quick question, and probably an easy one. I read, you know, Erin Mansfield's articles, and she does a great job on Vermont Digger. Question is, you know, I spent 4 months, I'm talking about the one-payer model and what you're trying to get from Medicare. I spent 4 months of the year out of Vermont. How do you account for that in getting money from Medicare to service people like myself?
That's a great question. So
thanks, Bob.
So basically there's a way – so this is the federal government's role. So the state wouldn't have anything to do with that. The federal government pays the bills, and they do it through a fiscal intermediary. And in the case of Vermont, that intermediary is located in New Hampshire, believe it or not. They would pay your bills out of state, and there's a way that they would do the math to adjust the rate paid to Vermont physicians and to pay for your care out of state or out of country the way Medicare currently does. And I want to be clear about one thing with the Medicare waiver. You know, every single document that we've seen from the federal government, there can be no change to any of the beneficiaries' rights and protections under Medicare law. This is just simply changing the way that providers are paid, and it cannot affect those important rights.
When we come back, we'll speak more with Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board, and we'll talk further about the all-payer waiver. Why is it important? What are the risks? What are the rewards? Plus, your phone calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. With me in this first hour is Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board. We've been taking your phone calls. Al has been patiently answering my questions. Let's go back to the phone line. Let's go to Ruth and Sheldon. Ruth, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Thank you. I'd like to say what I'm seeing. I'm seeing the Green Mountain Care Board being concerned about the well-being of the insurance companies, which we only have two, basically, and being concerned about the hospitals and their well-being, but not being concerned at all about the people who are providing the money for the insurance companies and for the hospitals. I see the hospitals remodeling, expanding, growing. Obviously, they have no concerns about people's inability to pay for it.
Thanks, Ruth. Yes. Actually, I was going to ask that in a different way, but that's thank you, Ruth, for the phone call.
So, you know, I have to push back on that a little bit. I think that, you know, I'm not going to speak for the board because it's five different people, but, you know, I think that the affordability of health care and the access to health care weighs heavily on every board member. You know, I think that when you're doing a rate review case for Blue Cross or MVP, you know, you can't do it any other way than mathematical and try to cover the cost of care. And, you know, that makes us basically make tough decisions where we say, hey, this has to go up by 3.7%. This has to go up by 7.3%. And no one on the board wants to do that. But it's our responsibility. And so we don't take it lightly, but we have to do that. And I would also say when you look nationally, you know, our growth in insurance rates for the last few years have been some of the lowest in the United States. I've already said it's not affordable. So affordable plus 3.7% isn't anything I expect a trophy for, but we have had some of the lowest rates in the United States. You know, Georgia has a growth rate of 69% this year, Oregon 29%. Connecticut is fighting over whether or not it's 27 or 17. And so the work that we've done with the hospitals to lower their net patient revenue and the impact that it's had on insurance rates has given some relief. But I do sympathize with the caller and understand that when, you know, you're staring at a $24,000, $25,000 cost of a family plan, you know, that is just, you know, a really tough thing to do as a family.
I was going to ask this question, and it sort of gets to what Ruth was saying. Why is it important to have a Green Mountain Care Board?
Yeah, so I think it goes back to the question of, you know, is this a, you know, are these regulated monopolies, you know, what size, you know, hospitals do we have? Can they set their prices on their own? And how does that work? And I think it's very important to have a Green Mountain Care Board. I don't think the commissioner format worked as well. I think that we operate in public in a very transparent way. I think that we have to come together as five citizens to make any decision with a majority of us. And I think that's just very different than a commissioner deciding a rate case in their office.
One of the hits about the all-payer waiver is that it's being negotiated in secrecy. You just talked about transparency. How do you respond to organizations like AARP and other ones about the secrecy in this transaction?
Yeah, so the federal government doesn't allow there to be transparency when it comes to these conversations because they won't negotiate in public. And so until it's gone through clearance with the federal government, they're not really into letting it be a public conversation. But what I will say is that once we get to the point where it is through clearance and we have an idea of what the opportunity is, before I would ever vote to say yes to something, there will be a lengthy public process to how we explain it, how we debate it, and how providers and patients decide if this is what's right for Vermont. And so no one should take from a meeting in Washington that a decision will be made because that decision has to be made after a careful analysis back here.
Let's talk about the all-payer waiver, the risk and the rewards. What are the risks? What are the rewards?
Yeah, so there's a lot of risks in our current system. You know, the current system, I just said, family of four, $24,000, $25,000 a year for a policy. In 10 years, that could be $41,000, $42,000, $43,000 a year. So there's a risk there. So the risks in the all-payer model that I see are that providers don't like it. You know, that we've come up with an idea that providers say, you know, we don't like the way the trend is done. We don't like the way the measures are done. We don't like the data needs. There's too much financial risk put on us, and we're not willing to do it. But the key thing that you need to take away from what I'm saying is that in the way that we've negotiated this, it has to be a willing provider. Because while it would be an all-payer model, it wouldn't be every provider and every patient. They have to be willing to sign up for this.
What's the reward?
So the reward is if we can actually get health care growing closer to the rate of inflation, we can put our dollars into things that we might choose to put into other than emergency room expenditures.
Let's go to Karen in Waterbury. Karen, you're on open mic with Al Gobay, chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board. Good morning.
Hi. I know this is a bit of a sidetrack from what you're discussing right now, but I'm calling you because I'm trying to reach Vermont Health Connect. I know that my check is clear to them, but meanwhile, I got a statement saying that I'm not covered. A lot of people don't find this out till they go into the hospital or into their health care provider and then get a bill telling them they weren't covered. I have called a couple of times in the past few days to Vermont Health Connect and been told every time that the wait period would be at least 90 minutes, which rules out being able to do it on a break from work, and I work during the hours their office is open. So in the paperwork, there was also a number for the Office of the Healthcare Advocate. I called that. They say not to expect a call back for a week in their pre-recorded message. Every time you call Vermont Health Connect about everything, you get placed at the bottom of the phone tree. There is no way to speak directly to a person on the level that you need to speak to without entering the bottom of the system and getting fed up the phone tree.
Karen, I know there's a lot of frustration. You're expressing a lot of frustration. Al, do you have any connection with Health Connect?
No, we don't at the board, meaning we don't operate it or run it or manage it. But first of all, let me just say I'm sorry because you know that this is not okay. And my email is al.gobay, last name spelled G-O-B-E-I-L-L-E, at vermont.gov. Send me an email, and I will get you in touch with somebody who will help you. And, you know, again, you know, what has happened with Vermont Health Connect has not made the conversation about how can we reform our healthcare system easy. I mean, it has clouded every conversation, and it's a very unfortunate thing, and hopefully it's improving.
One of the things, I just want to stay on this all-payer waiver for just a minute more. You know, we often talk about the risks, the rewards, but this is a change in a process. It's a disruption to a process in many ways. How do we determine if the disruption is worth it?
That's a great question. And so the first thing is that if we do the all-payer model, on day one, it's not like we don't expect all providers to sign up. In fact, the greatest risk would be if too many signed up too soon. So we call it scale, but it's going to have to scale up over time. And so, you know, as it begins small and grows, we're going to have to measure it to see if it's delivering the results that we need.
Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, if you can make it real quick, I'd appreciate it. We don't have much time left.
Sure. I can get 5 different kinds of car insurance and get bids by noon today. That woman just called with the problem that government can't do some of these things. And I think this is where government is in over its head.
Sam raises a good question here. Competition.
Competition and insurance. You know, I think that there's some parallels with car insurance and health insurance, and there's some things that just don't apply. And you know, I think that the conversation about the way in which the health insurance market is constructed on a state by state basis is, you know, it's a tough conversation to have, meaning it takes quite a bit of time to fully understand. But it's not the same as car insurance, and me wishing that it was more free markety isn't going to make that happen.
What are some of the obstacles? And I know we don't have a lot of time, but what are some of the obstacles? I mean, why couldn't we go and purchase insurance in Nevada, for example, and from an insurance company in Nevada?
Well, so the insurance company in Nevada would have to have contracts with Vermont hospitals. And if they don't, then you're out of market. Then it's way more expensive, and they wouldn't be able to compete. You know, the next thing is, like with cars, you know, knock on wood, you know, you may pay your car insurance all year, but you're hoping you're not going to have a car accident. And you may go 10 years without one. You may go a lifetime. Hopefully everyone who's listening doesn't have a car accident in their life. But with health insurance, you are going to use it. I mean, when you turn 50, you're supposed to have a colonoscopy. You're going to use it that year. So you're really insuring a foregone conclusion, and then the question is, how much does that foregone conclusion cost, and do you have contracts with providers in the area? It's just way more complicated than just trying to insure fire at the home, for example.
Al Gobay, thank you so much. I have a million more questions. We probably have a million more people on the line as well. But I thank you for the time that you've given us here this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's Al Gobay, who is the chair of the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board. Coming up, Talk Media News. And then Jasper Craven, a reporter for Vermont Digger, will be talking about relatives of members of Congress lobbying Congress. And then open mic. Want to get your questions you would ask to some of the debate, to people that are participating in the debate, some of the candidates that are participating in the debate on Thursday and Friday. This is open mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. That's right. We're celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com, and you can always listen to this show's podcast by going to WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, and live from D.C. is our colleague at Talk Media News, Ellen Ratner, who's on the phone joining us right now. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. Well, all the talk is on Hillary Clinton and her disease. What's interesting is there's some press reports saying that she actually has not had enough to drink, and they're encouraging her to drink. The thing the press is not reporting, because most of them are not old bats like me, is that when you get to be in your 60s, you don't feel thirst.
Mm-hmm.
And even though her staff wants her to drink, she's probably saying, I'm not thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
But her doctor needs to explain to her that you have to drink.
Do you think the Clinton campaign made a mistake by not disclosing right off the bat?
Of course they did, and they even made a bigger mistake by not talking about by not having the pool follow her home, because mm-hmm. people in the press are furious.
It seems to be a progression, and this falls into this area, Ellen, you tell me, but it seems like it falls into this area where she's been having a major problem with the American public on trustworthiness, in that they described it as, you know, allergies when she was coughing. They described it as getting overheated when she almost collapsed. They were talking, even when she was coming out of her daughter's apartment building and, you know, waving to the crowd and meeting the little child and everything. And it wasn't till that night Sunday night that they talked about her having pneumonia. Do you think that falls into this category that she's been having the problem with trustworthiness?
Well, I it's interesting because the Society of Professional Journalists, 40 journalists signed. I just joined them. I hadn't been a member. But after this, I decided to join. They sent a letter to the press secretary, to Obama's press secretary, saying, don't claim to be an open administration. And then they listed all the times or the kinds of things that the press has been cut off from. And the habit of cutting off the press is getting worse and worse and worse.
Hmm. She's had a Hillary Clinton has had a very rough couple of weeks. Can she recover?
Well, you know, Ben Franklin said a week is a long time in politics, and that was 200 years ago before any electronic media. So now that we're on a 24-hour news cycle, things happen very, very quickly.
The deplorable comment where she said that half of Donald Trump's supporters are a basket of deplorables, is that a huge mistake for her?
It was a huge mistake, but she wasn't well, which is another reason why she should have been off the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it'll go down as sort of a Romney mistake when he said, you know, 47% of Americans are on the dole?
Well, yes. I mean, look, it's hard to, I'm not in the habit of, putting numbers on contests. And I really, if somebody were to ask me whether she was going to win today, I'd say yes. But it's very close. It's an electoral vote. I actually think Donald Trump very well may win the popular vote, but she may swing it on the electoral, which comes in this whole question about whether we should have a popular vote, which happened after Gore v. Bush.
It'll be interesting, to say the least. Ellen, what else is happening in the D.C. area?
Okay, well, we have the Syria situation, and of course, there is this ceasefire that's supposed to be in effect. I've actually, one of the few people you know that's actually been to Syria, although it was years ago, and I will tell you that Syria is made up of many different components. And you can have Putin's people, Obama's people via Kerry, you can have dictator Assad all agreeing to a ceasefire. It doesn't mean ISIS, ISIL, and some of these other fringe groups, be it pro-tradition or not, are going to agree with this. And that's the problem.
They also, the Syrians claim they shot down an Israeli warplane today. Israel says no, they haven't. What's going on? That seems to be an expansion if Israel is involved in Syria.
Well, first of all, Israel has always been involved. There's no question about that. There's no expansion. My guess is they did not shoot down a jet, but they did shoot down a drone.
Mm-hmm.
And Israel is not commenting on the drone.
Congress is nearing a spending deal. Or are they?
They are. Well, we hope they are. They want to get out for recess for the elections, and they want to all campaign, particularly the House. But the question is whether the Zika thing comes as part of it.
And is that the big question now? Is on the budget? It's a continuing resolution, is what it is. But is it the Zika thing that is the Zika amendment that's?
Well, that is one of the things that's definitely holding it up. And the House yesterday, after meeting with the president, basically said they're not going to make this happen.
Hmm. So what happens? Do we have another stalemate? It doesn't seem to be in anybody's interest
to try and take money from other sources to fund his Zika initiative.
Got it.
Which he could probably do, but it might come from cancer. It might come from who knows what.
Anything else, Ellen, happening down there today?
Well, there's
a lot going on.
It's never a dull moment. What's fascinating is, what do you do when you're running for president and you're too sick or you have pneumonia? You can't make it. Who do you send in your stead? Well, of course, you can send your husband, the former president of the United States, but you can also send the president of the United States, which is what she has done. President Obama is doing a Hillary event in Philly today, or right outside of Philly.
So her surrogates are pretty high-powered, former president and
Very
current president.
Very high-powered surrogate on this.
Hey, Ellen, thank you so much for your
for
your time today. That's Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News, live from D.C., talking about the national events and political events nationally as well. Coming up, we'll speak with Jasper Craven from Vermont Digger. Fascinating article he wrote about relatives of members of Congress and the influence they have in Congress. This is Open Mic here. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program Jasper Craven, reporter for Vermont Digger. He wrote a fascinating article with a lot of information that I didn't know about, and I wanted to sort of follow up on that article. It's about relatives of members of Congress and the influence they have. Good morning, Jasper.
Good morning, Mike.
Jasper, who is Alicia Leahy Jackson, and what does she do?
Alicia Leahy Jackson is the daughter of our U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, and she has worked for the Motion Picture Association of America, which is the main lobbying arm of the film industry, since 2011. She started off at the MPAA in early 2011 in global communications, but last year in February she became a registered lobbyist and has been lobbying Congress ever since.
And how prevalent is it for groups to, where they hire employees that are relatives to a member of Congress, and why do they employ them?
Well, it's actually a fairly common practice, which is something I was not familiar with before I started reporting on this story. I actually found a 2012 Washington Post investigation that found that there were 56 relatives of lawmakers who were paid to influence Congress in various ways. This was a number tabulated after a 2007 bill called the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act was passed. And that bill aimed actually to mitigate the influence of family members as lobbyists, but it did not ban the practice outright. So even though this reform was passed in 2007, the practice continued and is exemplified with Alicia Leahy Jackson. Now, she was not a lobbyist at the time of the Post investigation, but when she began as an official lobbyist in 2015, the Senate lobbying disclosures she's filed show that she has been working on a number of issues very closely tied with her father. I should say that in the Senate, a lobbyist is explicitly prohibited from lobbying anyone they're related to. So Alicia is banned from directly lobbying her father as well as staff members of her father. However, she has been working on issues that are very closely tied to her father, including many that are addressed on the Senate Judiciary Committee, where Leahy is the ranking member and has also served as chairman.
What I found a little bit fascinating here is the disclosure itself is a little sparse. I mean, in the disclosure forms, you don't have to say who you've been lobbying in the Senate. You have to talk about the issues you're lobbying on, but not individual senators that you met with. Is there any move to make that a little bit more robust?
Sort of the problem here is that Congress is writing the rules to regulate itself. So by the power being held there, a lot of these rules are fairly squishy. As you say, these lobbying disclosure reports, which are a relatively new phenomenon, so that is good. There is some more oversight there, but they do not list which senators or congressmen or women have been lobbied, rather focusing instead on broad issues or agencies that have been lobbied. So it's hard to really figure out where and with whom lobbyists are speaking. But you can definitely see that Alicia Leahy Jackson has been focusing on issues of privacy, immigration, cybersecurity, internet rules, copyright law. The list goes on. Many issues that her father focuses on in the Senate Judiciary Committee. She also, for example, worked to influence policy around what is called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, sort of a wonky little part of government, but the Motion Picture Association cares about it, and this is a group that her father helps oversee. So she was directly trying to influence policy around a group that her father is looking over.
As we all know from the Batman movie, Senator Leahy has always been close, or has been close recently, to the movie industry. And they have contributed heavily to his campaign. You have outlined just how much, and it's not insignificant, is it, Jasper?
It's not at all. Since Leahy's daughter has worked at the Motion Picture Association, Leahy has received more than $400,000 in support from the entertainment industry. You look at disclosures, and his top 20 contributors include 4 of the 6 members of the MPAA. Those are all Hollywood production companies. They're Time Warner, Walt Disney, 21st Century Fox, and Sony. And I was actually going through a WikiLeaks disclosure of Sony emails. I'm sure you remember that big leak of Sony emails a couple years ago. And in there I found, email correspondence that mentioned Leahy discussing, for example, a fundraiser to be held at the house of Bob Iger, who is the current CEO of Disney. They were discussing holding the fundraiser and inviting Chris Dodd, who's a former U.S. senator and now heads the MPAA. So it is a very close relationship. Leahy acknowledges that closeness, though he is also quick to point out issues where he has broken from the MPAA on a number of issues, including most recently the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That's what I was going to say, was that Leahy says he's not beholden to the industry because he's broken from the industry or opposed some of the things that they have done in the past, looked at some of the issues that he has broken with. Some of them he's come under fire from outside the industry, particularly here in Vermont, particularly on sort of the internet issues as well.
Yeah, the Motion Picture Association really made a push a few years ago to try to scrub any copyrighted content from online. So, you know, for example, a film that Time Warner makes, they don't want any clips or parts of that film or music from the film or anything leaking online so that people can view it illegally and without the consent of the industry. So Leahy pushed what was called the Protect IP Act, which he characterized as a way to sort of get copyrighted content on offline and more closely regulated. But many, many major online companies, including Google, Facebook, Reddit, they all pushed back really hard because they saw this as sort of a bill from Hollywood that was that would basically impose draconian rules and regulations on these sites and could possibly shut them down if there was any whiff of copyrighted content on them. So Leahy actually lost that battle. In fact, it was one of the most successful examples of online activism. I mean, he really came under pressure for this pro-MPAA bill, and at the end of the day, he backed off of it. But, you know, there are many instances where he has pushed very hard for MPAA-backed legislation, and he is also, I should point out, quick to say that his daughter does not lobby him directly in the Senate, and also he says that any time he spends with his daughter outside of work is exclusively focused on family and sort of relaxing from the stresses of politics, and that there is no sort of talk of policy there either.
I wish my daughters wouldn't talk policy while we're at dinner, but that's neither here nor there. They will talk politics all the time with me. Leahy, this is where I found fascinating. There is an EB-5 connection to all of this as well. Leahy, as it's very well known in Vermont that Leahy has led the reauthorization of the EB-5 program five times, I believe it is. How is EB-5, we associate EB-5 with the Northeast Kingdom and what is going on there, but EB-5 is connected with Hollywood as well.
Yeah, this was another sort of odd connection that I had no idea before I started reporting this. But yes, EB-5 money has been used on Hollywood films. Now, I could find going back as early as 2009 instances where major Hollywood studios were getting hundreds of millions of dollars for films from this immigration program, you know, which, you know, to quickly sum up, foreigners can donate $500,000 if it's spent in a specific employment area to create a certain number of jobs, they can get a green card and come to the United States. And so there was actually an Inspector General's report from 2015 that focused on two of these Hollywood EB-5 projects. Now, these two projects that were picked out were by Sony Pictures and Time Warner. Again, these are two members of the MPAA, and they have given extensively to Senator Leahy. And what this IG report found is that basically, you know, there's sort of the Vermont Regional Center, which we speak about often. There's also an LA Films Regional Center, which focuses almost exclusively on getting EB-5 money for Hollywood. At this film center, what was happening, according to the IG report, is Time Warner and Sony were making requests for EB-5 money, but their petitions were lacking many required details. The companies, for example, Time Warner had not committed to actually using the EB-5 money. The job creation estimates were not sourced, and there was many questions about whether the jobs created would actually meet the standards. So there were many officials who were going to block these projects. However, a man named Alejandro Mayorkas, who used to head USCIS and is a an ally of Senator Leahy, he pushed really hard for these projects to be passed. He went as far as to create a deference board, which usurped the USCIS and other federal actors to get this money approved. And so basically this IG report points to the fact that he was unfairly approving these projects. There was another man who runs the regional center, and his name is, Rosenfeld, Tom Rosenfeld. And he runs the center, and he was also having inappropriate contact with Alejandro Mayorkas, saying, you know, we want these Hollywood films to get the EB-5 money. He was in close communication with Mayorkas. And the IG report found that the relationship between them was inappropriate. Now, Tom Rosenfeld actually has given $4,800 to Leahy. He donated that to his campaign committee shortly after Rosenfeld was put in charge of this L.A. Film Regional Center.
And one of the things that where this all came up, of course, with the IG report was the fact that the former director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Center became the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, and his nomination was pushed by Senator Leahy, wasn't it?
Yeah, so in the midst of this IG report, it had not been released yet, but there were signs there were signs that the IG's report would be pretty blistering when it came to Mayorkas's oversight of these L.A. film projects. The IG report also found issues with how Mayorkas was overseeing EB-5 regional centers in Las Vegas and on the Gulf Coast. And so a lot of Republicans were saying, we do not think that Mayorkas should be put into this new post of Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. This was in 2013, excuse me. And at the time, as you say correctly, Leahy was really pushing for Mayorkas to get this post, and he called the IG investigation a flawed investigation. It does not merit the delay of the confirmation process. And in the end, Mayorkas was confirmed to the post of Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. That's a deputy secretary. Sorry, it's a tongue twister.
And it's a pretty high-up position.
It is, yeah. And I asked Leahy sort of about the whole kerfuffle and alleged malfeasance at the L.A. Film Center. Leahy did not recall the specifics, but he has remained a strong advocate for Mayorkas over the years.
Jasper, we're speaking with Jasper Craven, reporter for Vermont Digger, and we're talking about relatives of members of Congress and the influence they have, and we're specifically talking about Alicia Leahy Jackson, who is the daughter of Senator Leahy. What does Alicia Leahy Jackson say, Jasper?
I tried to reach out to Alicia. I did reach out to Alicia through email, through phone, through other MPA officials to try to get a sense of how she worked to ensure that she was not influencing her father in any undue way. She did not respond to those requests, and instead I got a statement from the MPAA asserting that she has not lobbied Senator Leahy or any member of his staff. So that's sort of all I've gotten out of them. I was also sort of interested in what work specifically she was doing before she was a lobbyist. Like I said, she's been a lobbyist since February 2015. Before that, she was in global communications, and I was just wondering what exactly that entailed, because there's, you know, some experts on government ethics will say that even if a family member is not a registered lobbyist, they can still influence policy for relatives, and so I was just sort of interested in what exactly she was doing between 2011 and 2015, but I haven't been able to figure that out yet. Another sort of odd part of this story is even if a member of Congress is found to have been improperly lobbied by a family member, what basically happens is there will be either a private or public letter of reprimand, and then if it continues to happen, there are possible fines. But it's really just a slap on the wrist. Again, I think this is one of the issues that arises when an agency or a body is tasked with regulating itself, they're fairly toothless regulations. I mean, there is some disclosure, and that's good, but there could definitely be more, and I think if that were to happen, a lot of these questions would be more easily answered.
What are some of the watchdog organizations saying about what needs to be done in order to sort of beef up the ethics requirements and the disclosure requirements about this sort of situation?
Yeah, so I spoke to a man named Craig Holman, who is a campaign finance and government ethics expert for Public Citizen, which is actually, sort of ironically, it's a lobbying group that lobbies for more stringent regulations and sort of disclosure and ethical reforms. And he helped actually craft this legislation in 2007 that was aimed at mitigating, among other things, mitigating influence of lobbyists who are family members. But what he said is basically that there should be a ban. I mean, in the House, it's not even as stringent. So in the House, for example, if Alicia Leahy Jackson was in the House and Senator Leahy was a congressman, she would be allowed to lobby her father. So in the House, the regulations are much more lax. And the other problem is that, you know, Holman said that he believes that sort of the onus needs to be taken off the lobbyist. The lobbyist basically is supposed to set up this firewall, and by saying that there is a firewall, we basically take them for their word. And of course, you know, we want to trust our legislators, and you know, there's no real reason to believe that they're lying. But still, you know, if there was some sort of investigative unit or just a sort of a person who could ensure that the inappropriate lobbying wasn't happening, that would, I believe, sort of quell any questions or sort of frustrations around what actually is happening here.
Jasper Craven, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Mike.
For joining us. That's Jasper Craven, reporter for Vermont Digger. I urge you to go on Vermont Digger and read this article. Fascinating article about relatives of members of Congress and the influence they have, and specifically Alicia Leahy Jackson and Senator Leahy, and she being his daughter, and she having a very prominent role in lobbying for the motion picture industry. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Let's open up the phone lines. Let's find out what your views are on what some of the questions we should be asking at the debates at the Tunbridge Fair on Thursday and Friday for the positions of governor. Sue Minter will be there, at least. Lieutenant governor, the two candidates have confirmed. AG, the two major candidates have confirmed. And we're going to do a local state representative race in Tunbridge. What sort of questions should we be asking the candidates? Should it be about the economy? Recent polls have shown that Vermonters are very concerned about the economy. If you combined the economy with questions about budget and jobs, about half of Vermonters believe that's the number one issue. Is it gun control? There's been a lot of discussion in the primaries about gun control. That seems to have dissipated in the general election. Is it gun control that's the issue? Or is it health care? Health care is a huge issue here in Vermont, as one of our callers from Waterbury, Karen from Waterbury, had mentioned about Vermont Health Connect as just one example, and Al Gobay was talking about affordability and access. Access in a different way than we normally think of access. We used to think of access in terms of insurance, having access to insurance, having access to the ability to pay. And now we're talking about access in terms of accessing doctors, whether it's a primary care doctor or whether it's a specialist. Anybody that's tried to access a doctor lately, especially a primary care doctor, it's a wait. It's a wait and a half to try to get to a primary care doctor. So what are the issues we should be asking our candidates for attorney general, state rep in the Tunbridge area, LG, David Zuckerman, Randy Brock, and Governor Sue Minter has committed to be at Tunbridge? What issues should we be talking with them about? What questions should we be asking? What areas should we be focusing on? 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Tunbridge is always a wonderful time for debates. I expect to have robust debates with the Lieutenant Governor's race, the AG's race, and the local state representative's race. The format will be that we will open it up to audience questions down there. But it's interesting. What will be the issue? What are some of the questions I should be asking to the candidates? Let's go to Matt in Williston. Matt, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, all of the above. However, I think the question needs to be framed. What are your top five priorities in order and why?
So ask what are your top five priorities and why, and have the candidates talk about their top priorities.
And why they prioritize them that way.
Okay. Good suggestion, Matt. Thank you very much. Any other suggestions, give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Tunbridge Fair coming up. We have 2 days of debate. First day will be governor and lieutenant governor. We have Sue Minter on for the governor, who's confirmed. We have lieutenant governor Randy Brock, David Zuckerman, who have confirmed. The next day, on Friday, we have the AG race. We have Deborah Bucknam is confirmed. TJ Donovan is confirmed. Sorry. I have a relative named DJ. TJ Donovan has confirmed. And in the state reps race, Sarah Buxton, who is the state representative now, and David Ainsworth, who used to be the state representative in that area, are both committed to the debate. So which questions? Should it be the economy? Should it be health care? Or should it be something else? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. And when I got a moment, I also want to discuss sort of health of our presidential candidates. I mean, shouldn't we know more about our presidential candidates? And look, this is not all about Hillary Clinton, although I think they made a huge mistake politically in trying to hide this. This is about both candidates releasing medical information. I mean, have we come to the point where we have to have sort of an independent inspection of our candidates' medical records? Because it seems like both candidates are really trying to keep as much from us as possible. I mean, over the weekend, just on the Hillary Clinton side, and I'll get to Donald Trump in a minute, but just on the Hillary Clinton side, I mean, 2 weeks ago, we thought the coughing episode was allergies. And then that day when she – and look, if you've seen the video, it is a collapse. I mean, as they were getting her into the van, that was a collapse. And, you know, they said it was overheated. And then she came out onto the streets of New York after she had been taken to her daughter's apartment in New York City, Chelsea Clinton's apartment. And she came out and she said all was fine. But then that night, after the video came out, there was something that needed to be explained, and the diagnosis of pneumonia came out, and the problem with that is today they knew this Friday night that she had pneumonia. So why they didn't disclose that, why they didn't move on to that is something that most people, liberal as well as conservative, are scratching their head on. Liberal news organizations as well as conservative news organizations are scratching their head on because they think the disclosure aspect of this is important. So we're left wondering on both sides, whether it's Trump or Clinton, is there something else going on here? And it only feeds into this conspiracy theory on both sides. So should we evaluate the health of both candidates by them releasing as much information as possible and then having independent people evaluate it? Look, in 2008, John McCain unloaded more than 1,000 pages talking about his melanoma, which led, if you remember right, in 2008, that was leading to speculation that he was unfit for office. But professionals, after he released that, inspected those records, and it was really a useful exercise in transparency. So have we come to the point where we have outside experts needed to certify the claims of the campaign? And by the way, Donald Trump hasn't released enough. I mean, a doctor writing a note in 5 minutes? Come on. Trump says he's going to release more. Clinton campaign is saying they're contemplating releasing more. Have we come to the point where we need an independent evaluation? Interesting question. So two questions that I'm asking this morning. Number one, what should I ask the candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, AG, and a local state representative race in the Tunbridge area? Number two, have we come to the point where we have to have independent inspections of candidates for presidential candidates? Do we have to have independent inspections of their medical records? That leads to a lot of interesting things in terms of privacy and some other things. But you're running for president of the United States. Do we need that? Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Wow, I mean, so much to talk about. Question one, I would ask the governor, lieutenant governor, and so on, a list of their donors and how much they gave. Question number two, definitely we need to have our candidates at high levels like this, maybe governors too, that we need to have an independent evaluation of their health records if they're unwilling to release their records, as John McCain had done quite openly.
Thanks, Rob. List of donors. We can get the list of donors quite easily from, at least in Vermont, from the Secretary of State's office. Now, it may not be timely enough, as some people are claiming, that we need to do same-day sort of reporting on donors, but we can. And then again, I'm fascinated by this question about presidential candidates, because are we asking too much if we ask them to submit their medical records? Let's go, Tom. I realized I've blown through just about every break there is. Rama, if you could make this really short, I'd like to get you on, pal.
All right, real short. The first thing, it's not what you ask the candidates down in Tunbridge, it's how you ask it that's of interest to me. I like open-ended questions because I find how people answer a question to be just as interesting as to what it is that they say when they respond. On the presidential candidates and other candidates and medical records and such, I don't know about saying that we need to have an independent review of them. I think we as voters need to be smart enough to expect that there's, at a certain level in politics, we have the right to actually stare into their personal lives, whether they like it or not. And It's funny. Franklin Delano Roosevelt spent half of his presidency in a wheelchair. Jack Kennedy had severe back problems throughout his short presidency. You know, but these are things we didn't know about. Now we pick up on them because they start happening. They're recorded on everybody's cell phone. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we do have the right to know personal details about people who are running for president. So I think that it should be voluntarily put out to the public. And then, you know, I mean, I don't know where you're going to find some so-called nonpartisan experts that are going to give us the unvarnished view of what's in the medical records. But if you put them out there, enough people will have enough say-so.
Rama, thank you. Great comments. Welcome back to Open Mic. Welcome back to WDEV's Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I want to thank our guests today, Al Gobay, chair of the Green Mountain Board. Also, we had Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News and Jasper Craven, reporter for Vermont Digger. Thank you all for appearing on Open Mic this morning. And discussions tomorrow about how to increase participation in local government issues and a preview of the debate with some of our political experts. I want to thank all of you for your phone calls. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond, of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Talk to you again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.